Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2021, and this is the final stream of this, the 10th night, and this is with the Distributist. Now, the Distributist, this is always a hotly anticipated stream each year, at least by me, but I'm pretty sure by quite a lot of other people as well. So, welcome, Mr. Distributist.
Everyone calls me Dave. I had the misfortune of making a rather unpronounceable name when I started blogging, and I never was able to lose it. But everyone's called me Dave since then. So, yeah, it's fine. I'm really glad to be here. It's always this great tradition that we get to have sort of this retrospective on the year every year during December. And I think everyone just looks forward to it. Oh, and, you know, 2021 has been quite a year. A little bit of an eye-opening year, I think. Although I think the same thing was said for 2020. Really, it's more or less been a continuation of the same trends.
Yeah, I mean, I think that 2020 was worse. I think that it was much more of a dramatic year. You had COVID, BLM, and the US election. Whereas this year, we've had January the 6th and more COVID. But I think last year was just such a roller coaster. It was a nightmare.
Last year was chaotic. People didn't understand what was going on. In 2021, it's pretty clear what's going on. There's no questions. It's just, I guess people who are still in denial have questions. But for everyone who has eyes to see and is not kind of overcoming some mental block, and if we're sincerely looking at things, it's very clear what we're dealing with. It's
yeah, I mean, for power, the perceptive ones among us, like you and me, it's very clear what the truth is, and that is that the Dems are the real racists.
Well,
and there are only two genders.
Yeah, if race is privilege plus power, I can't think of anyone who has more privilege and power than the Democratic Party. So maybe they really are the real racists. But I'll say this, though. I think, you know, one thing I wanted to say, I think that it's deceptive because in some ways, you know, we're less the right, the distant circles that oppose the mainstream. It seems in some ways like they're less powerful. But in many ways, our situation is more powerful and more advantageous than it's ever been. And that's because I think that a lot of the illusions have fallen away. I think that it's very clear right now that the parasocial game of social media is just over. I know we said this, you know, a few years back that the right just could not play this game. Essentially, people have been saying it since 2016. If you look back, people were admitting that it's just a matter of time before they ban us all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now I think it's we've had to internalize this, and once we get over this,
I'll
once
tell
we
kind you of, what, yeah. Just let me interject there because some of us have really had to internalize this because we've been banned from I'm not going to go on about this. I'm just going to mention this because I think it's relevant that you know you're still on YouTube, Academic Agent is still on there, Morgoth is still on there, but so many of us aren't, and I'm one of the ones who got banned this year. Way of the World on the same day as me.
Oh wow!
And it really does make you think. I always was sure that it was going to happen, but once it does happen, it's freeing, but it also does make the reality just completely in your face. Like you are now. It's not that it's going to happen one day. It has happened. Yeah. You are now no longer welcome in the global public square of YouTube. So it does make you feel, it forces you into that mindset of like a real outsider. But weirdly, since that's happened to me, I think that other people have adopted the same mindset because they've seen. Yeah. I think everyone now knows. We're just hanging. We're sort of. And I don't mean to, this is in no way meant to demoralize you or whatever, but I think that everyone who's still on YouTube feels like they're dead men walking in a sense, that they're not really still on YouTube. They just happen to, for now they are.
I certainly am. I mean, I'm going to get banned eventually for sure. The death nail is when the groups associated with the ADL start to notice you.
Yeah,
that's and I don't think they have yet because well, you know, I cut a wide berth around them. But they will eventually, because eventually I'll be the, you know, you'll be the right, most right-wing person on YouTube. And then there it goes. Exactly. I think what's so amazing though, you know, in all of this is like how, what's so amazing
just let me finish what I was saying. I didn't say it very well. And after that, I'll not interrupt you anymore.
Because
I think this is a point that deserves to be made. Somebody said that, you know, when I got banned, it was like the end of an era. And I think that's the point that I'm trying to make here, and I'm not saying that I was the first, because I wasn't, but I think it does sort of make sense that a lot of people thought if he's still on there, then we're still in the game. And then once I wasn't, that sort of forced everyone to realize, including me, but everyone else as well, okay, it really is a new era. So that's what I mean to say. And it's that, of course, Way of the World is also relevant there as well.
But the question now is, what was the era? The era, like, how did this thing occur? How did this thing occur from 2015 to 2017? The right basically just hijacked social media in a way that people never thought it could, and it had no right to be able to do. I think that in many ways we've learned a lot of bad habits from this, but when you think about it, the right really has no reason to be able to dominate social media for two reasons. The first one, the one that I've noticed that most guests have talked about here, is sort of the obvious one: the people in power, the real people in power, the basically the establishment religion of the elites, which we call the cathedral and NRX circles. You can call whatever you like. They really hate the right wing, especially the sort of nationalist or religious traditionalist right wing, and they'll do anything to keep it out. And that's the one that you're very acutely aware of in 2021. The other one that you might be less acutely aware of in 2021 is that it's very, very difficult to operate in as a right winger, as a defender of tradition or morality or order, because it's easier to create chaos than it is to create order. It's easier to create disruption. And progressivism, for the majority of its life in the 20th century and the 19th century, has basically manufactured tiny bubbles of chaos and has used that to incrementally take the next step. And this is just definitively closed to the right wing. It's not something that the right wing can do. It's not something that the right is temperamentally inclined to do, because it's not the kind of thing that we want. And so it's basically like the left is pushing the cart down the hill. The right is pushing the cart up the hill. In addition to that, the left has, you know, the entire town militia on its side pushing downward. And yet in this little period of time, the right was able to actually meet them, which is kind of amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, it is. See, my explanation for this, because you're right that we didn't have any right given the mindset of the people in Silicon Valley, it's surprising that they ever let us on. However, what I would say about this is that I think they perhaps were honestly laboring under the same notions about freedom of speech that we had. I think they still had that 90s idea of, you know, the Wild West of the internet. Isn't it also exciting? This is part of we're all part of the future here. It's a new era, a new paradigm of social discourse. And I think they liked that until 2016, when Brexit happened and then Trump got elected. Now, in 2011, I think I must have mentioned this last year, last millennial, in 2011 or 2012, there was a Google conference where one of the two creators of Google, one of the two founders, said, "We are approaching a state," and obviously I'm not quoting him verbatim here, this is just from memory, "We are approaching a state where censorship of the internet will be literally impossible." Yeah, exactly. And he was saying that.
But we are doers of the impossible here. Yeah.
But at the time, he was saying that as a good thing. In the same way that there was that guy high up at Twitter who famously said, "We are the free speech wing of the free speech party." Now, I don't think that that was just marketing speak. I don't think they were just saying it because they didn't have anyone to placate, really. They didn't need to say this stuff.
They believed it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I think they said it because they believed it. They actually enjoyed it. I think perhaps because it meant that they were, like, they were the purveyors of the party where everyone wants to come and have a good time. They were the hostess with the mostest. It made them feel good about themselves. It was like, yeah, Twitter's a great platform and we're in charge of it. We're the ones who made it. Google, we've ushered in this new era of cool hipster programming in Silicon Valley. We are the ones at the forefront of this. And it's changing the world. And eventually it'll be so freeing, it will be so liberating to the human spirit that censorship will literally be impossible. 4 years later, he would never say that, of course. And so I think that they still had that rather individualistic mindset, or rather just freedom of speech. I think they really believed in it in some sense until they realized that in the battle, in the free marketplace of ideas, when there is a level playing field, their ideas don't actually win. Well, I think that really scared the shit out of them.
Yeah, or at least a few of them. You see, the thing is that all of these explanations about why this period happened boil down to the insane and unprecedented weakness of the left in one way, shape, or form. Free speech was the tool of the strong, and it was wielded by the progressives when they were strong. And it was wielded because they had dialectic strength, you know, first because they were pushing the cart down the hill. They were creating chaos, which is always easier. Second, because genuinely they had ideas and promises that were plausible and seemed to be backed up by evidence and seemed to have a certain kind of appeal to them. That era is coming to a close. And also, I should say that the progressives themselves were incredibly, I don't know, I don't want to say intelligent, but they were, to borrow sort of an overused term on the right, they were high agency individuals, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and certainly the people at Google were. But now you see, I mean, and what's happened is that the old school sort of boomer left, the social Dems, the people that are really embodied by people like Joe Biden, these people are totally detached from reality. They've made a number of promises, you know, over the last 60 years that are manifestly undeliverable, and nobody in their right mind thinks that they can deliver on them, starting with the promises they made about racial integration and racial cohesion. And ending with any number of promises, and I would say a bigger one actually would be the lies surrounding the sexual revolution and how family life would behave in a moral vacuum, which is obviously such a definitive, it's just so definitively a mess that it can't be covered up anymore. And now after conducting three or four sort of large narrative reframings across the 90s and the 2000s, they're totally out of ideas, and they really only have a certain type of denial. And there are, I guess, you know, people who are a little bit more true believers on the left, but the true believers on the left are all so radical at this stage. They've all had to embrace such a high degree of radicalism that they're detached from reality in a completely different way. Their beliefs are linguistically incoherent and have no connection to reality. And as a consequence, nobody who has like any consistent connection to reality really can hold them sincerely. Yeah. And so this creates this bizarre sort of ruling coalition that sits atop the world right now, half radical, half establishmentarian, yes, half communist, half capitalist. It's sewn together with whatever patchwork it needs so that it can get through the day, so that it can make enough promises for the future to cover its obligations in the present. And let's hope things continue on this way. And everyone knows they can't, right?
Yeah, and another undeliverable promise would be Social Security when people are living to the age and to the state of Joe Biden. You know, you can't, you know, into their 80s, into their 90s with dementia, this is a very, very difficult thing to financially accommodate for any economy. Even the richest first world economies don't really know what to do with this problem. So that's that idea that the state will look after you is, I don't know, I'm not sure if it is feasible. But another question that emerges here is, you said that I don't know about the term the left and the right at this point. Mm. I'm not sure how applicable they still are. And here's one of the reasons why. You said that the left is a force for chaos.
Yeah.
And I agree. And I think you're right also that that's one of the reasons they wanted freedom of speech so much, because they were breaking down conventions and traditions and so on. And they are a force for chaos, and they do thrive on dissolving boundaries, dissolving hierarchies, discrediting systems, discrediting traditions, mocking traditions. They're nihilists. They're the sort of court jester. Well, worse than that, really. Sure, they're a force for chaos and disarray, but they are, what we're seeing now is the opposite of that, a totalitarian system of control emerging. So the question would be, is this the gulag after the joyful Bolshevik revolution? Is it the hangings and the beheadings after the joyful Paris revolution? Is this what the left always does? Or, in other words, is that a sort of absolutism and shrill hatefulness that underlies the joyful destructiveness and eventually emerges once that has done its job? Or is the left today just the useful idiot that has laid the ground for a class of people who really aren't left-wing in any meaningful sense and are actually totalitarian technocrats without any real ideological convictions at all?
I think I would just sort of reframe this question. I think we misunderstand totalitarianism. I think the temptation is to think of totalitarianism as the tool of strong governments. I tend to see it as the tool of weak governments that have basically dissolved all of the supporting institutions of society. These technocrats and the World Economic Forum, they don't want to use hard-handed measures against their populations like they currently are in the West. They're being forced into that because nobody believes in what they're selling anymore. And so what I see totalitarianism is, once the religious impetus that undergirded your society has burnt off, societies are forced to use totalitarianism as a final measure and as a way of hanging on to power. And that's what we're seeing right now. When I say left, though, I'll clarify this, that I think the concept of leftism does have a coherency to it, because the structure of power very obviously moves in a direction across the 19th and 20th century. And that consistent direction is easy to find in hindsight, and it's easy to predict. You can look ahead and go, okay, I want to be on the forefront of progress. So you can make a distinction between the people who disagree with the system and are going in the direction that the system has already moved, and the people who disagree with the system and want to pull it in a direction that is not in the direction that it typically moves. And that's why I think leftist is actually a useful term. In the sense, you know, this creates sort of a leftism that's inherent, that's sort of implicitly fake. It creates young people who can pretend to be rebels with the full knowledge that by the time they hit their 30s and 40s, the system will have caught up with them and they'll be able to slide into positions of power. And so their dissidence, their opposition to the system can be entirely fake because there's a built-in insurance policy.
Yeah, but on the matter of religion, and that's an interesting point, by the way. I appreciate that. I think it's an interesting idea that all of these rebels know that by the time they can smash windows, that they know that by the time they're actually needing a career, it won't matter because yeah, the system will approve of that kind of thing by then.
There are so many professors that did just the same thing and never stopped them from getting tenure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. On the matter of the left is, it dissolves the religious fabric that undergirds society. Yes, but don't you think that COVID is now a new religion?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's well. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of a great literally another great awakening. You know how religions have these surges inside of them every now and again, and COVID is certainly one of them. Every single progressive true believer has gone full in on COVID, and it gets them excited in a way that, you know, I don't know. I mean, global warming was supposed to do this for people. But COVID
is abstract
right now. Yeah, global warming is too abstract, and it didn't have the immediacy, and they were never able to really get everyone on board. And COVID is yeah.
People don't care about polar bears as much as they care about granny.
Well, yeah, I mean, and also the polar bear stuff was total BS too, right?
I'm not sure about the granny stuff either.
Well, yeah, I mean, COVID kills people in their 80s.
Yeah, it does.
Right. So, you know, that's, you know, and I don't think that, you know, I do think that the COVID probably has been detrimental to the population of grandmothers in the way that I'm not so sure global warming has actually decimated the population of polar bears.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Let's not get into that because and I agree with you anyway. I think the more interesting thing here is, if COVID is a religion, then doesn't that contradict your notion that the left dismantled religion?
Well, I mean, it dismantled religion and it replaces it with its own, right? But what's happening here is that the religion is becoming less and less believable. I mean, the real religion, the real religion of the left is, I mean, the really powerful stuff is one unified human race without ethnic boundaries, without religious boundaries, singing about, you know, John Lennon's Imagine. That's John Lennon's Imagine doesn't feature anything about COVID or climate change. And that's what really animates them. The problem is that it's so obvious that every single time progressives get into power and they push the envelope on this Imagine utopia, the John Lennon vision of the future, what they manifestly produce is further and further away from that. And so, you know, at least when you're in crisis, at least when you're staring down some apocalypse, when you're experiencing an eschatology, the internal contradictions and the lack of belief, it's a way to mitigate that. In the same sense, for instance, so you're aware of the Ghost Dance. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Oh, you haven't. Okay, so there's this really fascinating thing. So after the battle of, you heard a Little Bighorn and Sitting Bull and Custer's Last Stand.
Yes.
Yeah, so there was this, the Sioux were defeated. These were Plains Indians dancing with wolves, basically. And they were moved into reservations. And basically their entire life was disrupted. Their religion made no more sense. They couldn't basically live in the way that their ancestors had lived for hundreds of years before them. And what emerged was this really weird type of hyper Sioux fundamentalism called ghost dancing, where they would perform this ritual that they believed would allow them to become impervious to bullets. And they would summon the spirits of their Indian ancestors and they would retake the North American continent. And so what you have is, you know, when this religion, when its sort of normal facets become unbelievable, it takes this extraordinary form and starts imagining that it's in an apocalypse. And it tries to impose that apocalypse on its people. You start seeing in dying religions, you start seeing like suicide cults and all this stuff. It's very strange. And I think that in some sense, when you have these explosions, like in COVID, you're seeing a kind of ghost dance for the progressive white boomer. Not the boomers necessarily, but certainly like the Gen X and the millennials who believed in this stuff. Because I really do think that this vision, this Obama John Lennon vision, is totally unbelievable. And so when you have this society that can't come into existence, and it's obvious, you have to open your eyes and see it, you start imagining an apocalypse. And obviously, it's not exactly the same, right? Because in the case of the Plain Sioux, they were not in power. And the net result of the Ghost Dance was a very famous massacre that was kind of brought on by the pseudo-military confrontation with the federal government. And, it didn't result well for the Sioux Indian. But it's much more dangerous now, because now what we're dealing with is we're dealing with a religion that's essentially dying, and it has almost 100% of the power in the globe.
And what is that religion? You don't mean COVID?
Well, I mean, I think COVID is just a manifestation of this religion, in a similar way that ghost dancing was a manifestation of the Sioux religion, right?
Yeah,
The ghost dance didn't invent new gods. It imagined the old gods coming back from, I don't think that, I would say, COVID is progressivism's ghost dance, but that's a little bit of a misnomer, because there was only one ghost dance because it exploded and got a bunch of people killed. This is going to get a bunch of non-progressives killed, and they're going to keep on inventing these catastrophes again and again and again, and they're going to keep on exploding, and they're going to keep on resulting in worse and worse things.
See, that's a different way to look at that. I didn't expect you to say that. I thought that you would look at it in terms of power elites, and what we've seen over the last couple of years is the new elite, the people who really are in charge, simply taking over and directing society as they wish.
Yeah.
Which is more my, I mean, you're talking more metaphysical and spiritual, that these things are almost imminent in the world, these forces.
I don't think those are two mutually exclusive explanations.
That's true, I guess. Yeah. Go into that.
I think these people like Bill Gates are believers in this liberal vision of the future. And they think that the only way they can accomplish this, they understand that fewer and fewer people are believing in this world that they want to produce. And that necessarily, if fewer people believe it, this will threaten the direction they want society to go in. And I really do think that this power grab has been forced. It's enforced from circumstances that the elites do not find favorable. They would want everything to be like in the 90s. In the 90s, that's when they got the majority of their power. We handed the reins of our societies over to these people, not recently, but over the last 30, 40, 50, 60 years.
Yes, indeed. You see, it seems to me that the big question here, the big sort of mystery is, these people claim that there are contradictions all over it. Why do they claim to talk about liberty, and they claim to care about liberty, but they clearly are prepared to destroy liberty? I mean, that's just obvious in the last 2 years. They claim to care about inequality, and they want to solve that, but what they've done over the last 2 years has massively increased inequality. And then there's the whole health stuff. The vaccine, yes, I'm prepared to accept that it has a protective effect for the over 80s. Although I don't know that, but I'm prepared to go along with it. But it clearly is not necessary for the young. And it does look like it causes blood clots and so on. I mean, that's why we've got all these footballers dying. Mm-hmm. So it's not about health either. I mean, none of their claim. In fact, what they do directly contradicts what they claim to believe in.
I guess, knowing human psychology, I don't find this unusual. I think this is what you have with all people who want to build this type of utopia, is that they get enthralled to this vision, and they don't care that the vision is destroying the actual thing that they want to protect. I guess I'm trying to psych out the elites too much here, but I think the most important thing is to understand, in my opinion, how weak the left is across all of the things it used to be so good at, they can't produce films that anyone believes anymore. They can't tell stories about the future that anyone believes anymore.
Yeah. They can't be funny anymore, but that's because they are in charge and they can't afford to laugh at themselves.
I guess, but I feel like they're worse than sort of establishment comedians in the 1950s who were doing sort of like clean comedy, right?
Yeah, that's true. In Britain we had the two Ronnies and comedians like that who were actually funny. They were actually talented. They weren't destroying society. They weren't corroding conventions and traditions, but they were funny. Whereas you just can't say the same about Sarah Silverman.
Oh my, yeah. It's really weird because it's also, I mean, there's also this dimension of ugliness to Sarah Silverman, because if you look at sort of the original comedy, sort of like benign comedy, you see this even stuff like Jerry Seinfeld. A majority of this sort of benign comedy is sort of mocking the slight contradictions that we all experience in our day-to-day lives. Yeah. But that in turn relies upon some kind of established normalcy that we all participate in, and that we co-experience with people. And it's based on an understanding that we all kind of love that thing, and therefore we can laugh at it safely.
I mean, Friends, like, you know, I was never the most conventional guy, but even I could identify with, you know, I could understand, I could sympathize with the world of, I've forgotten the characters' names now, but Joey and Chandler. Some hellish progressive thing of today, I cannot identify with those people. Those characters. I mean, it's like watching a different species.
Or just to take my favorite comedy show from, which I think is actually a BBC comedy show, you probably have seen it, Father Ted.
Yes, yes.
So yes, I know the person.
Very funny. Yeah.
The person is incredibly anti-Catholic, but a lot of Catholics like that show, and it is actually strange. Incredibly anti-Catholic. The only way it's really funny, and
Graham Linehan.
He said that he could never make that show because his hatred of the Catholic Church would have shown out if he had made it post 2002. The reason why that show is at least a little funny, well, I think it's actually really funny, is that it kind of relies, I think it's more funny for Catholics because it kind of relies on you knowing a certain kind of priest and understanding that Catholicism is always going to be there. And so in some ways they can kind of get away with lampooning, you know, making a lot of jokes that would really be quite aggressive in another context. But in the context of when that show came out, they didn't seem aggressive. Whereas, no, I haven't seen this new Sarah Silverman Christmas monstrosity, but I mean, it's put together by Seth Rogen and Sarah Silverman. And you know, it's just so obvious that the ethnicity and the religion they're making fun of is not them.
Yes. Yes. It's one group attacking another group.
It's one group attacking another. It's on so many different dimensions. It's one religious group attacking another. It's one social group attacking another. They have no connection to the things that they're making fun of. It's as crude as it reminds me of that, a kind of crude form of comedy where you're making fun. It's like blackface.
You see, you're right. They have no connection to it. They are one group cruelly mocking another group and denigrating them. Now, what you said about Father Ted, I feel the same way about a 70s sitcom in Britain called Rising Damp, which has the main character is a working class landlord. He runs a boarding house, which I believe is something that doesn't exist in America. So you might not know what I mean, but it doesn't really matter. It was once said that I don't know if it's true or not. Maybe they do exist there. But the point is, he's this working class guy who has pretensions and is, but really doesn't know much about the world. But he thinks that he does, and you know he is racist, and a lot of the humor, especially in the first season, is lampooning his ignorance, and his racism. Now, you could say, oh, that sounds subversive. They're deconstructing the white working class. It's making the white English male look like an idiot. But the thing is, I don't really think they were. I don't really think it was mean-spirited or deconstructivist. I think it was our people laughing at ourselves, like mocking ourselves for flaws that we know we have.
Comedy has to be subversive. At a small level or a large one, it has to be subversive.
Of course, but not vitriolic. It doesn't have to be hateful. And I think that's what you see now, where if they did that, they wouldn't even joke about things like that nowadays. You know, someone, a racist, it's unthinkable that they would make a character like that even slightly accessible in a contemporary program. But if they did, it would be the loathing that the writers and directors and actors have for that character would be much, much more obvious, to the point where you wouldn't even be able to laugh along with him. He wouldn't be allowed to have any charm any saving graces, any redeeming qualities whatsoever.
And see how it's been corrupted, right?
And so it wouldn't be funny. That's the thing. In the end, it wouldn't even be funny. It would only be funny for the kind of people who watch Santa Inc.
If you're in the position, if you're part of this group that Silverman and Seth Rogen, I mean, it's the situation is what makes this impossible. You can't make fun of your own group because that would be showing your hand and letting other people potentially score points on you. And you can't make fun of someone else's group because it's obviously disgusting, because you obviously have contempt for the other groups.
Well, a certain group can get away with doing that demonstrably because they've done it with Santa Inc.
Well, but, I mean, they can get away with punishment, but they can't get away with it by making good product.
Yes, I see what you mean. Yes, you can't succeed because it just comes across as hateful. And it does. And that's why people have recoiled from Santa Inc. I mean, I haven't heard anyone saying anything good about it.
It is. I mean, I think, you know, people are saying like racism is based. I mean, there is a, I mean, I think blackface is genuinely still disgusting. I mean, it's disgusting because the people who did it had contempt for the African-Americans they were depicting, even if there was some kind of plot or external joke for it. I just think that making fun of an out-group and using that as humor is just, we naturally recoil from it. And, you know, and I think that all we are getting is various forms of blackface in our modern humor. We're getting comedians that are making fun of religions and classes and ethnicities that you're obviously not a part of, and that they obviously have contempt for. But again, I want to highlight that this is not out of strength. This is out of weakness. This is out of the fact that their worldview and their religion does not make sense anymore.
See, this is a reflection of the fact that self-love is often difficult to distinguish from self-hate, and confidence it can often be difficult to distinguish from insecurity, because the outward signs of it are similar. Like, that's the whole point, that you're trying to deceive people that you're confident but really you're insecure, but you hide your insecurity by acting confident. In a similar way, a weak regime hides its weakness by doing strong things in order to assert that I am strong, sort of thing.
Nailed it. I 100% agree with this. This is exactly the conclusion we should be coming to. I've noticed that a lot of people, you know, there's sort of been the stumbling block, and I noticed this in Philosophicat's talk, and this is something I think is a mistake, that it's a bad habit we've picked up from the last 2 years. When we see the left becoming weak, we immediately seize the reins and we try to do what the left did or does. And it doesn't really work for the right. People talk about this book, Rules for Radicals. This is Saul Alinsky's book.
Yes, yes.
Saul Alinsky's book doesn't work for the right because we're not that kind of thing. We don't benefit from making the situation more chaotic. We only benefit from making the situation more ordered. And as such, you know, we can't out-parasocial the left. The whole parasocial relationship, it sort of reached its apex in people like Vosh and Demon Mama. and all of these other sort
of
how did I know
that you would somehow get to Bosch?
I just think it's a great example. I mean, I think it's a great example of where the dialectic is, right?
Go into that. Let loose.
Well, I mean, okay. So, I mean, well, Bosch has a few distinct phases. And the first one is the phase where he kind of comes onto the scene in, what was it, 2018, 2019? And he comes onto 2000 basically as a Destiny clone. Destiny Done Left could be the title of Vosh. And he basically succeeds by playing a fast frame game and shouting down his opponents. And what happens is that he gains popularity because young people naturally like the left, because it tells them everything they want to hear already. It's basically easy to tell you that you can just slide into an easy life. And this is going to be, young people want to hear that constraints don't exist and that they can get away with whatever they want. Luckily for Vosh, he comes in at the very moment when the cathedral is really cracking down and all of his really big opponents basically get banned right off the platform.
Oh, absolutely. He doesn't have to go up
against, you know, Nick Fuentes or any of the people who are making a big splash. They're all gone.
Exactly. And the ones who would dare, who would want to take, who are still there and would take him on are too scared to, because it could be the thing that leads to their getting banned.
Yeah. For instance, you know, he goes and Stefan Molyneux, and Stefan Molyneux dumpsters him. He destroys Vosh. Like, and this is well into his career. And I don't think Stefan Molyneux is particularly an agile debater. And then he goes on Sargon, and Sargon, who has many talents, I don't think debating is one of them. He absolutely gets the better of Vosh, I think, on two occasions. And so like, this would be humiliating, except right when that happens, basically, there's the implosion.
Yeah, the alt-right certainly get banned.
Well, yeah, they're well gone. I mean, I don't think people are even calling themselves the alt-right at that stage. But now you see, you know, what's transitions in 2020, which was sort of the banner year for this, is that the demand for performative politics and parasocial relations skyrockets in 2020. And what you have basically in Vosh is he transitions from being the debate bro to being, let's complain about Steven Crowder, you know, while I play video games and do Twitch. And this, he sees this with Hassan Piker too, right? Hassan Piker has no wonder. He's this gym bro who's a communist who's made by his uncle. And you know, he makes millions by playing video games and just shouting Marxist platitudes.
It's pathetic. It's so just loathsome in its insincerity and shallowness. But there's a more sinister. I mean, we can go in just to nail that down. What I mean is, I don't think any of these people really care about anything. I don't think they have any real convictions. I think that they're grifters. I don't think they give a shit about the working class or the poor or whatever. I think they probably do care about the new left concerns, like, you know, gay rights and whatever.
Yeah, that's their thing. That's what they, but in that way, what they're doing is they're dissolving societal bonds, sometimes even linguistic ones. It's gotten to the point where it's basically just linguistics. All of these identities are contradictory and incoherent, and
they dissolve on touch. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, what does it all amount to? That people should be allowed to define themselves in whatever way they want, and they should be allowed to buy whatever products they want. And anyone who gets in the way of those choices, those free decision-making processes in the individual, is the enemy. Yeah. Anyone who tries to circumscribe what choices people can make is the enemy. And you know, and this gets us to the other part of it, which is, on the one hand, I don't think they really care about the needy. I think that they are grifters, but they're also authoritarians, aren't they? I mean,
yeah,
Vosh is quite incredibly culturally imperialistic for someone who claims to care about other people's freedom of choice.
Well, it's because what he's doing, I mean, I think it actually does derive probably from his soul, but we should never assume that. His audience doesn't feel powerful, and they're looking for an outgroup to feel powerful against. And so I'm imagining that the authoritarian measures can be raised or should be raised against their political enemies, makes them feel powerful, and you're participating in that experience. I need to emphasize this. This is sort of the apex of politics on social media. It would not behoove any of us to create a right-wing Bosch. It doesn't, because what's the point of it? It doesn't build anything. It just plays into an algorithm and creates people who want to sit back and feel powerful by fantasizing some kind of revolution in which their wishes will be fulfilled, whether they make sense or whether they don't.
I mean, Vosh, the key things for me are that he has said that he would like to assassinate Vladimir Putin if he could and install a pro-Western leader. But what does pro-Western mean? It means what I said earlier, that it's someone who really believes in nothing. Personal license, liberty. And then he also said that he would invade, or he would approve of invading a U.S. state that was trying to secede, get it back in line and whatever regime change. So again, he's not really interested in people having freedom of action, at least not at the state level. Because he doesn't believe in anything but. I don't know. I was going to say Western liberalism, and then I was going to say the U.S. state and the deep state. I'm not sure that what does he believe in? I'm not sure.
He believes in the empire of John Lennon's Imagine, which is exactly what Bill Gates believes in. They have different means of achieving the empire of John Lennon's Imagine, but it's the same religion in different forms, I would say.
Right, right.
And it's the vacuous society. It's the vacuous society and death to the enemies of the vacuous society.
God, yeah. I mean, that's scary because it's demonic. Yeah, to be in love with vacuousness or vacuity seems.
They're in love with something, not vacuity. They're in love with power. And the way this works.
So then they don't care about personal liberty for people.
Oh, no, of course not. No, they don't care about liberty. They care about power. And when you dissolve regulations and rules, that creates a space where power can flow in. As if you dissolve the religion and the social mores of a society, that necessitates totalitarianism.
And this is something that's been said about the left in previous eras as well, that in the end, they don't actually believe in anything that they claim to believe in. It's all, whether it's the working class, minority rights, or whatever, it's really just the naked love of power in and of itself, or a fascination with power, or a lust for power. And what would you say about that?
Well, I'm sure it starts as a love for something else, and then it becomes sort of a love of power as it becomes more and more corrupted. And that I think that's the story of Google. It's the story of, well, I don't know about Vosh. I don't know if you ever really believed in anything, but it's certainly the story of Google. It's certainly the story of how Google went from being the free speech wing of the, or was it Twitter? Whatever.
That was Twitter. Free speech, Google was the don't be evil thing.
Oh, there you go. Right. Don't be evil to, you know, now we're controlling how discourse is managed and how information is, we can unpublish books. We can unpublish websites. You know.
Yes.
That's nothing. Nothing more evil than that. I think. And that's,
we can destroy the livelihoods of decent people who are providing for their children, for their families. We can take the food out of their kids' mouths.
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, the thing is that I think the situation the right is in right now is. we don't really, we see this problem of totalitarianism. We see this problem of basically our society dissolving in front of our eyes. And we don't really know how to deal with it because our imagination is sort of constrained by what the left has done. The only thing we've ever seen working is various versions of leftist strategies tried over again. And, you know, I think what we need to do is, because this whole parasocial social media thing isn't working, we need to actually try to do something different. We need to kind of go back to fundamental strengths that we have. And I think that needs to be the new basis for a non-progressive movement. You know, I think at the beginning of the conversation, I handed you like the slide deck with, I was going to make a video on this. I thought I'd discuss it tonight, but I had like seven things I think the right is, are kind of like the virtues of the right or the strengths of the right that we need to explore.
But before we get on to that, could we just finish up this thing about the left and power? And because it's a very thorny thing, because as I said, a regime that's in its death throes is quite difficult to distinguish from one that is very forthright. Is it doing this stuff because it's powerful and insisting on its new social paradigm, or is it doing this stuff because it's brittle and fearful? How can you tell the difference between those two situations when the outward signs, the outward behaviors are the same?
Well, that's a good question. If you were to ask a true believer in this stuff, in the sort of Great Reset, New Economic Forum person, I'm sure there's a bunch of cynics that are just power addicts in these circles, in these banker circles, but there are true believers as well. I think what they think is going to happen is that artificial intelligence is going to march on down from the sky and literally be a deus ex machina to save their vision of humanity from itself. And that will be the end of their problems, potentially the human race, who knows? But their idea is, okay, we are basically going to just try to keep all of our much too human instincts tamped down until this new reality, this new singularity can become manifest. I would imagine that's what they actually believe.
So in that case, well, I guess that would lend, that would point us towards the digital currency, the digital ID, all of this international surveillance that they're talking about. You know, it seems to me that I don't know. I guess my question is, should we distinguish between the left from, let's say, 1920 to 2020, 2015, and from then on, or from about 2000 on, the left has been moving towards imposing its social paradigm. But should we distinguish between it's what we're seeing now, the Klaus Schwab, George Soros, Bill Gates, is that still the left? Or is this a new elite that are just taking over from the left because the left is out of ideas and isn't actually good at ruling? Whereas these people are good at ruling and unafraid to impose order. You see,
I don't think they're good at ruling. In what way?
In the sense that they're not afraid to just, as I said, deplatform people, ruin livelihoods, change the laws in a country to suit themselves, build international organizations to impose their will, demonize whole communities, whole races, whole countries, in the case of Russia.
Less ethical people are coming to the fore because
the ethical people...
don't understand that this is what their religion has become. I mean, for instance, do you think that our ruling class would love to implement racial equality if they could, in the way they imagined it in the 60s? That's what they imagined would happen. But they can't produce it. No matter how much they try, no matter how much money they plug into this problem, they can never produce this. And so, you know, what happens is, like, okay, you can't produce this. and you can't produce this and you can't produce this, pretty soon, you know, when you can't produce this, the person says, someone will come in and go, okay, you know, what we really need is just a system that keeps us in power. We need to put down the forces that are pointing this out, and we need to actually convince people that that the only way that they can, we can have this is for them to delegate power to us. And then it's sort of a win-win situation, right? They delegate power to us and we're able to control the situation and prevent this from exploding in our faces, or, you know, they don't. And then we have an easy scapegoat about why we haven't produced the utopia yet.
Mm. Yeah. And that would also justify dissolving national governments as well, because they're incompetent and they're sort of in the way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot said about like this, the whole, like the billionaire class and these Davos set. I mean, they're believers to a certain extent, or they're silent. And I think, the reason I think academic agents said this is that culture is downstream from law.
Yes.
What has occurred in the West since the 60s is that these true believers put in a bunch of mechanisms by which anybody who wants could essentially attack non-progressive ideas with money behind them. This largely came through a bunch of things like civil rights disparate impact. But the net result is that if you have money and you do something that can be perceived as racist, or you're in a senior managerial position, the activist organizations who are true believers have so many levers to take you out of power or to attack your holdings. There was this, was this owner of a basketball team. This is right at the beginning of the Great Awakening in like 2013. He said something like racist to his girlfriend over a private call, and she released it. And this guy who outright owned the sports team was forced to sell all his assets and to face all of these civil rights suits brought by employees who thought that they had somehow been disadvantaged by this person's private beliefs about race, which had never come up before, that this had been leaked. The net result is that of the rich people who are out there, they know damn well that if they're either kooks like Peter Thiel, or they know damn well that money aligned in a right-wing direction doesn't stay. It gets dissolved really, really easily. And so sort of the dream of sort of these right-wing elites is at least at this stage, highly illusory.
This is a reference to the desire for a right-wing Soros.
Yeah, a right-wing Soros is really hard to imagine. At least in the sense that, you know, there were the Koch brothers, obviously. But the Koch brothers were libertarians. They were, you know, keep the government's hand off my oil subsidies type people, right? I don't doubt that they were true believers, but their beliefs were not running in a direction they were very notable not running in a direction that crossed the pieties of intersectionality.
Yeah, so they were true believers, but they were true believers in not very much.
Yeah, exactly. Which
I think is very typical of libertarians.
Yeah, and so, you know, you're not going to get a reactionary George Soros. I think that there probably would be, you know, there probably are rich people who sympathize with right-wing causes, but they're also aware of the precariousness of their position. An oligarch doesn't stay an oligarch if the rest of the oligarchy turns on him. And once you sort of betray the combine, so to speak, you know, your wealth isn't really yours. You're a stakeholder in this thing called the global economy. And this combine has an ideology. And if you're not a team player, there are so many levers by which your colleagues can punish you for that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for every dollar that goes from a millionaire's pocket to a distant cause, if that distant cause looks like it's doing anything too scary. That millionaire knows that he's probably going to lose $10 for every one he sends. And then his question is, well, what's the point, right?
Yeah. And especially if it's not going to be well spent anyway.
Yeah.
That dollar. Because I know that these people are, well, stereotypically, these people are accustomed to thinking in the long term. So they're not going to think, well, that content creator can't pay his rent this month. I better do something about that. They're going to think, if I do something about that, that could really screw me up.
Yeah, well, yeah. If the content creator that's funded by you does something that is a scandal online, you know, the left or the activist class funded by your rivals and the oligarchy, they know where to go to, and where they're going to go to is the funding. They're not going to go to the person.
Yeah,
you know, like no one asks, like, oh, Hassan is directly connected to the Young Turks, and the Young Turks have these financiers. I imagine George Soros is one of them, right? So if Hassan Piker uses a racial slur, that's almost like, you know, the New American Center or whatever, the Society for American Progress used this racial slur. So let's go to them, right? Like,
No one cares. And the other point I was making there was that they're thinking about the long term, so they're not going to think about donating to a content creator. They're going to be thinking about building, you know, an institution, something that will persist. And there aren't any such institutions, and they've all been infiltrated. And I think they might well be looking for a new one that they could help to get started. But that's not the likes of you and me. We probably wouldn't even know of it. We probably wouldn't hear of it until like 50 years from now, when it's grown and become an influence in society. Now, there might well be, you know, our George Soros might well be out there somewhere and funding such institutions just now, but we wouldn't know about it, and we won't know about it for a long time.
Well, I think that actually I would agree and disagree with you, and this is sort of getting into sort of some of my points, but I actually do think that this begins at a lower level. I think that when you imagine an institution arising that's not progressive, it's got to be insulated in some way from the laws and the activists and the oligarchy that exists currently. So, like, in what way could its money be insulated? The one way is that this is Spectre and they have a super secret volcano island, you know, with like, this is that one thing where it's like they have the entire island computerized, only like one guy, a man with a golden gun, I think it was. That's a James Bond one from like the 70s, probably, really bad.
Yeah.
But that's the secret volcano island is one way to insulate. The second way is crypto and distributed social media networks. Okay, that's fine. I tend to think that in isolation is not going to work. I think that will be a promise that actually is going to be a major crack in the cathedral eventually. But the third is just what a number of people have talked about on Millennial, which is sort of the fast, cheap, and out of control, the organic way, where the institutions emerge. A lot of different institutions emerge all at once with tight-knit, cohesive members, and there's so many of them, and they're so hard to sort of track down and punish that the powers that be can't possibly handle it, and they just have to ignore them and try to bat away their more pressing problems.
Yeah, that does sound like a it does sound like a strategy that would work or have the best chance of working.
And those are the three ways that I can see you can insulate yourself against this, the apparatus of the law and the activists and the oligarchy.
Yeah. So is there anything else you want to say about that?
Oh, no. I mean, I kind of wanted to, you know, mention that briefly, is that I'm more interested in the last of those three options, right? Because, I mean, crypto is going to do what crypto does. And distributed social media networks are going to do what they do. And eventually, I have a feeling that this is going to be kind of like Linux, where it's like the tortoise and the hare, where, you know, there is the spearhead of what's happening with technology, which is always controlled by corporations. But then there's sort of the tortoise, the open source tortoise that comes in afterwards, where what once only could be done by a corporation could be done by virtually anybody.
Mm.
And so I think eventually the sort of Web 3.0 is going to come about, which you kind of see prefigured in things like Urbit, where the new thing is distributed. And in that, in which case the possibilities for censorship are much more limited. I still think that's only one part of it, but I think that has to be sort of met with the portion that is organic. And that's obviously the portion that I'm most interested in.
Yeah. I don't know if there's anything else that we need to clear up from earlier on about this, this weird dichotomy. It strikes me as a contradiction that you've got the left, but they love big business. So is it meaningfully the left anymore? Or was that their hatred of big business? Was that just a hatred of the establishment, which now manifests as hatred of anything traditional?
For instance, all the anarchists of the 19th century, like Peter Kropotkin, I think, the guy who wrote the Victory of Bread or something like that. He wrote this anarchist manifesto that the left loves. When the Russian Revolution happened, he was a guest of honor of Lenin, and all of the early anarchists supported it. Okay, they were against government, so were they off put by the fact that Lenin was using government?
No, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. That's an irony. I just Googled it. It's the conquest of bread.
Conquest of bread. Thank you. Yeah. When chaos erupts, power becomes all that there is, and the necessity to wield power becomes paramount. And anybody who doesn't want to wield power becomes a joke. And that's why the left will throw in behind corporations just like it threw in behind government when Lenin came to power. It always does this, and it can't not do it.
And also, I think this is a defining feature of conservatives, that they don't want to wield power. And so whenever something like this comes up, they're the ones just pathetically backing up whoever is in charge and whatever is the status quo, or whatever was the status quo 5 minutes ago. They just don't want to wield power. And you see this again and again with Jordan Peterson, for example. I think he is a conservative, and he's a very typical conservative in the sense that he's terrified of changing anything. He's the kind of guy who I can imagine if he walked into his office and one of the ornaments had been rotated 2 degrees clockwise, he would notice. Because, oh my gosh, a threat. He's that neurotic. And I think that a lot of conservatives are like that, or they're just sort of the opposite. They don't understand the significance of anything. They just seem to go through life assuming that everything's for the best and everything will turn out okay and you don't need to worry about the left.
Well, I mean, I think there's the third possibility, which is that they know that they don't have power. They know that, for instance, this comes up in neo-reactionary circles all the time. You know that the Queen, you know this more than I do. You know that the Queen has the power to dissolve Parliament
at will
and declare herself absolute leader of Britain and rule without Parliament. But is the Queen a coward for not dissolving Parliament and taking the power? She could do it as readily as Boris Johnson could snub the mainstream establishment on COVID, right? But they don't, because they know that the second they do that, they would lose it. And so even if they're 100% honest, they know for a fact that they do not have the power to overthrow the system, and so they never do it.
Yeah, that's another possibility.
Just like I know for a fact that the Supreme Court's not going to overturn Roe v. Wade. They'll find some way not to do it. And that's because the ruling class does not want Roe v. Wade overturned.
Yeah.
And so they know what will happen. If they overturn Roe v. Wade, the ruling class is going to come together and they're going to find some exception by which they're going to bring Roe v. Wade back. Roe v. Wade, by for non-American viewers, is the Supreme Court ruling that legalized abortion across all 50 states and all trimesters. And yeah. It's sort of the main target for the pro-life Supreme Court justices. They know that they're the elites, and here I just mean the entire educated class of the West, thinks that this is a good idea, and the net effect of them transgressing would be the restoration of the previous status quo, with the addition that they would go down in history as persona non grata, the same way that Enoch Powell did, the same way that McCarthy did. Yeah. And so the question is, like, Enoch Powell's options. I mean, people who see Enoch Powell, what they see, you know, what they see is, okay, Enoch Powell, he came out and said this, I believe the same thing, but did he actually stop mass immigration into Britain? No, all he did was mass immigration continued apace, and then he became disgraced from his own social circles for the remaining decades of his life.
Yes, and he was transformed into a weapon to use against people like himself.
Exactly.
He was repurposed by his enemies, which is appalling. But of course, the same thing was done with McCarthy. So yeah. There was another example. Oh, yeah, about the establishment wants Roe v. Wade to be retained. In the same way, the establishment wanted Derek Chauvin to be found guilty, no matter what, at any cost. He was going to go to spend the rest of his life in jail. And they had at least one backup plan if that was ready to go immediately if he were to be found not guilty. But on that note, why do you think that Kyle Rittenhouse got acquitted?
I don't think it was worth it. I think that the media was feeling a bit embarrassed. He was a sympathetic first of all, there was an enormous amount of abuse on the prosecution's part. I'll put it this way. When George Floyd played on TV, it created political capital from the left, because regardless of the exonerating details that were there regarding Chauvin's conduct, and I won't repeat them, the sort of initial facts on the ground were galvanizing for the left, and it was sort of impossible to ignore. Kyle Rittenhouse, on the other hand, was something that the left couldn't really hold it or touch it with any amount of, they couldn't construct a coherent narrative around Kyle Rittenhouse. It was basically a bundle of inconvenient facts. The only way they could succeed about it was lying directly about things that were on video. And I think it was really obvious that if Kyle Rittenhouse found it innocent, it would actually be better for the cathedral. They could bury it. They wouldn't have to deal with it again. Whereas if Kyle Rittenhouse had been found guilty, it would have gone to trial. It would have come up again. And, you know, I think that, you know, there were people that were pressuring the jurors. You could see that there were actual journalists who were following the bus that carried the jurors to the undisclosed location.
Yes.
With all this insane stuff.
The evil of journalists is sometimes beyond belief.
Yeah, but, you know, in the case of, I think, the George Floyd, where it was really obvious that, you know, there would have been retaliation or social retaliation for the wrong verdict from polite society, I think it was clear in Rittenhouse's case that, you know, really, okay, we lost this one. It's not worth it. You know, let's just let this go away.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's really because of the video evidence. You can't, there's only so much that you can twist video evidence when something has actually been caught on film. It's very difficult to reauthor the narrative on that, because the reality is there on film. There are multiple things which I think just played against. I mean, no power is all powerful. And even this elite has to sometimes bend to reality.
Look how much this elite has lost. It's lost all of their soft power mechanisms are destroyed. That was their thing, soft power.
Mm.
It's hard power. I don't know how they go back to using soft power after this.
After this, do you mean after COVID or after
COVID? Now? Yeah.
Right. Okay. Could you go into that?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, it doesn't, you know, people don't want to come out of lockdown because they don't want to deal with the reality of trying to actually convince people that what went on for the last 2 years was good and not their fault at so many levels. And people, I want to say this, this is sort of a digression, but sort of true. I kind of fundamentally disagree with how a lot of my colleagues have dealt with COVID. They deal with this thing like the left deals with this thing. They deal with this like, oh, we need to have a story about, you know, what specifically is wrong with COVID, you know, how, who benefits from it, how they lied, you know, possible things we're hearing that could be true that we're not so sure about. Dude, there's only like two questions that actually need to be answered, and they're super easy. And they've already been definitively answered. The first thing is the government and the society, or the people who rule society, the government and the establishments, the academic establishments in the West, are they criminally mismanaging COVID? You could turn this into three. Did they create COVID? Which is part of the first question. And then secondly, are the powerful and the people who control these establishments and populate them benefiting from COVID? Who contests this? Obviously, those are the only questions that need to be answered, because anything else is quibbling over details. There isn't a single question that meaning. I mean, there are sort of temporal questions, like, do I take the vaccine? Do I get boosted? Do I wear a mask? Yeah, like those questions, right?
Yeah, we don't need to get into that. So,
but this is important, actually, right? Because the cathedral would love it if the question becomes, okay, we're going to have a big debate in society over who's the idiots, the people who got the vaccines or the people who didn't get the vaccines. Like, they love that conversation because more people got the vaccines than didn't. And so when you try to convince people that the vaccines, you know, were put, well, I mean, if there are concerns, like the football players collapsing, absolutely go after that. Like, that's a legitimate point of contention. You need to explore that and find out what's going on. And come to the truth on that. But when it comes to sort of retroactively casting the decision to take the vaccine as good or bad, that's absolutely not the battle you want to face. You want to ask, is the government criminally mismanaging this, and are they benefiting from criminally mismanaging this? And those questions are definitively answered. Nobody left, right, or center sincerely answers no to both those questions. They are obviously criminally mismanaging this day after day after day, and they're obviously benefiting with this in terms of finances and power.
And yet, as you said earlier, they can't ever go back to soft totalitarianism after this.
They can't.
Soft control. So how that's not benefiting them, is it?
Oh, it's not, but I mean, they're not using hard power because they want to use hard power. They are using hard power because they can't pull off soft power. The question about the virus's origin, like the second they go back to soft power, the question over the virus's origins immediately becomes relevant, and that has some inconvenient answers. The question about how they've mismanaged it again and again and again has questions and needs an answer. As long as they're in crisis, CNN can be forgiven for being rank propaganda, because there's something instinctive about humans. They understand that when they're in the war, when they're doing politics, truth needs to be sacrificed. And in some sense, this is a properly evolved human instinct. You know, when you're in a war, in some sense, you can't afford to quibble over who's to blame for this or that.
Yeah.
But, you know, and so because of that, the question over the ultimate truth-tellingness of our leaders and how they're managing our society can be indefinitely put off if the establishment sells the narrative that it's perpetually at war with some group of bad actors. That was originally Trump. Then you know, January 6th allowed them to transform the vindictiveness towards Trump to the vindictiveness towards Trump supporters. in their many forms.
The deplorables.
And as long as you can continuously be at war, and you can continuously keep people psychologically in a state of war, you will allow people they will not really care about truth that much, nor will they need to. Or they do need to care about truth, but they have a properly evolved human instinct that prioritizes immediate danger and war over the truth.
Yes.
And I hate to say that anyone should ignore truth, but in, you know, based on how we deal with our environment as evolved Homo sapiens, that's not necessarily the worst thing. You know, I remember this joke we made at the expense of Kraut and Tea back in 2018, where there's this truck hurling at him, and when you try to warn him away from this truck, he starts asking you about the details of the truck's make and model, and when those don't make sense, he denies the existence of the truck and gets hit. Right?
Did I say that?
Well, actually, it was a meme that you said. And then I made an animated video on it back in 2000. This is before we even ever talked together.
I vaguely remember this, and I think I might have come up with it myself, actually. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
It's not wrong, right? Because when a truck's barreling towards you, you don't care about whether my description of the truck is accurate or not, right?
Yeah.
And so, if indeed we are in this end of times scenario with a disease that's going to murder us all, you know, do you care if the vaccine is 60% effective with a 10%? I mean, I'm just making these numbers up. You know, with a 10% chance of egregious side effects, or whether that's 50 with a 20, or, you know, how do I move these complicated levers of variables around? And what does that mean when you aggregate it out to a billion people? People tap out. That's like describing the details of a truck that's barreling towards you.
Mm. Yeah. There was a question I was going to ask based on this, but it's escaped me now. But I guess I would. One thing I did want to say is I think that they are. Well, a key thing about what you've said is that, yes, I think you're right that they're keeping us in a state of crisis and emergency and all this. Actually, literally, legally speaking, they're in a state of emergency.
Yeah.
But
there's an emergency spending too.
But it's artificial because the disease is not that serious. So it's something that they've obviously decided upon to just. I mean, I don't know how long it could become, like in 1984, but it's just this perpetual war that doesn't need to be going on at all.
May I be indulged in a speculation here? I guess I'm going to do this anyway. I don't know any of this. This is just me talking in my butt, but our governments have borrowed an enormous amount of money from their own central banks, which are in turn backed by creditors at the international banks. They come out, these creditors are probably cutting them leeway because they're in a state of emergency. They come out of a state of emergency. They're going to want to have some interest paid on those debts. And all of a sudden, when that happens, you know, the federal government goes into QE infinity and inflates the currency, or the solvency of their ability to continue up on those commitments is just dissolved. What if they're keeping the pandemic going because they're worried that the second they get out of it, their finances fall apart?
So you obviously don't have much faith in the idea that this is a real elite plan that's very clever. And, for example, that they're devising an entirely new economy, an entirely new way of organizing the world.
Oh, yeah, they want to do it. They want to do that. That's what they're going for. They're going for the whole idea that, you know, we're going to be in pods and AI is going to manage the world. That's the idea, right?
Yeah, and UBI to, you know, fund people and all that.
I mean, UBI is secondary because everything's going to be given to you by the pod. It's like a slightly more roomy version of the Matrix, equipped with Mark Zuckerberg's little metaverse, you know, to actually live your life in. I mean, that's the plan. I guess the question is, I mean, right now they could try to just implement it, right? They could try this and march people. I mean, I just don't think they're going to pull it off, right? I mean, if they can do it, you know, I don't know. I guess I guess the question is, can they do this or can't they? And I don't think they can.
Well, why not?
I think that their supply chains are going to fall apart. And I think that, I mean, I don't know, maybe people would, I actually would be curious if this is sort of the implicit question that's sort of looming in all of our conversations here in Millennial is can they actually execute the Great Reset? And I think that the geopolitical situation is going to fall apart. I think the supply chains and the inflation are going to fall apart. And I think their political coalitions could fall apart.
And also there is China.
Yeah, that's part of the geopolitical thing, right? Like, so,
yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously China and Russia think that they're benefiting from their relationship with the regimes in the West right now. But they might become less, you know, placated. And when they become less placated, you know, they're going to try to recoup some of their losses in ways that our leaders aren't going to like, possibly concerning Ukraine or Taiwan.
Gosh, so many things that deserve to be talked about. But we don't have time. And, you know, it is 20 to 4 in the morning here. So.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, let's get to your... Because this is something more... perhaps more fruit, more nourishing, more positive.
Sure. No, I wrote seven points. Yeah. So I have 7 points that I think the right can do these things. I'm not saying it is necessarily, but it can do these things and the left can no longer do these things. For myself, this is the direction that the right should be thinking in.
Right. Okay. So this is a set of ideas that we could take on board. So please go for it. What's the first one?
Okay. So the first one is, this is probably pretty simple. The right promotes values. The right can promote values that lead to human thriving and health, physical and spiritual. I think health in both the physical and spiritual sense have to be a forefront issue in all of the right's communications with the cathedral. Because this is something that modern people can understand, and it's something that the modern left is obviously failing at. The cathedral's failing at it, aka you know, the moderate left Tony Blair type, and the far left is failing at it even more. They've created a set of even more unhealthy people. The Vosh and Demon Mama crowd are manifestly in poor spiritual and physical health.
Yes.
And their values are terrible. Quintessential example, the left cannot come up with a replacement for how men and women or any sexual people are trying or should interact with each other.
Well,
there's
no coherent
way they have for this.
Yeah. And also it would be against their ideas to do that because their whole thing is that people should do whatever they like. And it's nobody can decree what is a good or bad lifestyle.
Yes. Well, yes. And also because they promise people things that are obviously not coming to fruition. They promise women that they could have a promiscuous sexual lifestyle in their 20s and then slide into family life in their late 30s. For most women, that does not work.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and then I want to kind of go on from this because I think this is probably the least to discuss here. There are so many dimensions upon which leftist lifestyles make promises to both men and women, and they just don't come to pass. Young men have been lied to, too. Oh, just be a nice guy. I mean, this is sort of a cliche of the manosphere, right? But just be a nice guy. Just be a feminist. And, you know, everything will work out, right?
Yeah.
Obviously does not work, right?
Absolutely not.
So the right can actually embody spiritual health. And I think the spiritual part will kind of come into focus after the other points. So I guess these are sort of white pills. You know, these are sort of things that the right, these are strengths that the right can flex more. The second one I want to say is the right has a series of sincerities. So we have a sincerity of spirit in the sense that we believe the things that we say. I think this is a big deal. I just don't think that the left actually believes itself anymore. I mean, I don't think, and this probably is the reason why I have this different attitude than most of the other guests. I don't think that Klaus Schwab genuinely thinks that he can implement the singularity I don't think that Bosch actually thinks he can implement communism. I don't think they believe it. I don't think they believe it. They think that they can get rich for a few decades. That's what they actually believe in. And this is bullshit so that they can get rich, you know, for the short period of time that they have before they have to admit that their larger vision is absolute bullshit.
So Klaus Schwab is a grifter.
I think Klaus Schwab is a grifter, yes. This is just my perspective. You know, I could be wrong about this. If Klaus Schwab isn't a grifter, I know that the social media personalities on the left are grifters. How could they not be? They're either that or they're under some insane delusion.
Well, the other thing that we didn't bring in about Vosch is that there is this rumor that he has links with the, you know, that he has handlers.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's true or not. It's something I heard.
I think he's trying to seem more powerful than he really is and cooler than he really is, to be quite honest.
Right. Okay.
Maybe he is. Who knows? Actually, I mean, the FBI does do this. They do just go around and dump money on people that they think are like doing random stuff that are going to, you know, create some opportunity on the line. They've been known to do this, right? So obviously they can't rule it out, right? But we also can't rule out the possibility that this is just him, you know, beating himself off. Pardon. That was crude. I'm sorry, but yes.
That was very crude.
Okay. Wanking as
yeah. Okay. But I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry.
So this is sort of, and I should say that each of these things is something that we should avoid, right? So we have a sincerity of spirit, and that's why I always think the irony, it can be, it's good in moderation, but really it's something that the right should be a little bit cautious about. You know, it's something that's really more of the tool of the left, and the fact that the left is forced to be ironic about everything is a sign of weakness. This is one of the reasons why the left no longer believes in itself. The right can do sincerity in the way that the left can't. The next sincerity I want to talk about is a sincerity in language. We say what we mean and we mean what we say. The left has completely destroyed its own language. So I had this series a while back that was called the Magical Word Series, right? Which is about like the series of words that basically have no meaning except for the fact that they stigmatize the person who's attached to these words. A great example is racist. Or it could create benefit for people who have these words. Gender is another one, right? Gender has no meaning, but it confers some kind of privilege or disprivilege depending on how the left uses it, right? And that shouldn't ever be, right? Because the meaning of a word should convey the consequence, not the form of the word, right? But magic words, the form of the words is what conveys the consequence. These are also known as buzzwords, right? They don't have meaning. All they do is indicate that a certain person is good or bad or whatever. So frequently, you know, people on the left or the right, they say, oh, we need our own set of right-wing buzzwords. This is impossible. You can't do this. You can't create buzzwords because the buzzwords are created by power and they're used to secure power. And this is something you can't create. For instance, the alt-right was a good example. The word the alt-right was used as sort of a way to indicate that the group was cool and hip and alternative. It took them like a year to turn this into the equivalent of Nazi. There are a number of things that people who use this term did to not help themselves, to be sure. But this was not like some kind of left-wing buzzword. And I see this too when you get to people like the CRT crowd, you know, the Chris Rufo people. Now, to be clear, you've heard of this whole CRT Chris Rufo furor in the United States. I think people have talked about this, right? Did I lose you, Woz?
No, I'm here. I'm just dealing with a stupid thing in the comments. hold that thought. I want to deal with this. Klaus Schwab is not a Rothschild. This is another fucking fake news thing that I've talked about several times now, and it really irritates me because it keeps floating around. I've just linked in the comments to a post that I made on Telegram back in July, the 1st of July. His mother, I can't remember the details now, but the woman who people think is a Rothschild moved to America and had kids there. Klaus Schwab's mother is from Switzerland and lived there. I think she moved to Hamburg or something. It's a different family. It's just one of these really annoying things. I wish people would do a tiny amount of requisite research before they pass this stuff off. But unfortunately, not enough of the content creators did. So they keep saying this and people keep learning it and thinking that it's a precious piece of info that they've got to spread around. It's not. It's bullshit.
This is one of the things that I could actually skip to this point that I'm going to get to, is that the right can be an ally to truth. The left has made itself an enemy of truth. If the right sticks to what's true and values that, that is a strength. But if it doesn't, you're taking this gift that your enemies have given you and you're just dumping it in the trash.
Well, right? I think what I would say about this is that, now maybe you'll say this is overly cynical of me, but I would say that one of the lessons of the last 2 years is that the truth doesn't really matter. In the same way that, because we, as you said, we are in a war, and the truth is the first casualty. But also, the public are just bovine. They just don't care. They just want to be told what to believe and what to say. They don't care about the truth. Now, you might be correct that the truth, nevertheless, has power, sort of intrinsic to it.
It does in the long term.
Yeah, but it's not. It doesn't have power over the public. It doesn't impress the public any more than an equally glittery lie impresses the public.
Power can overcome truth in the short term. So truth does not matter to the people who are wielding power. But we don't have power. We can't get power to the extent that the World Economic Forum or the Joe Biden administration or Boris Johnson has, but we could always get truth. And so if we take truth and we keep truth, that means that we have something that's powerful in the long term, even as power overwhelms it in the short. And this is why I really try to stay away from these long, convoluted descriptions and org charts about the people who, you know, are behind the scenes. It's because if there is one inaccuracy in that whole thing, even if there are some truths, that inaccuracy is going to hurt me more than, you know, obviously I'll internalize what I think is true and hold it as a possibility. But kind of having that proclaimed, it kind of destroys my grip on truth.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it depends on the individual circumstance, the individual situation. I think that, see, what I've taken from the last 2 years is that power is, I don't know, it's this contest between truth and power, and you might be correct that in the long term, the truth wins out.
Inevitably.
Yeah. But certainly in the short term, the truth just, I don't know. You can see how they can just plant narratives, the public go along with it, but even the experts go along with it. You know, that's another thing that's been amazing about the scientific community, the health, the medical community, the journalists who should know better and probably do, but they go along with it. This astonishes me.
This is how it's been always. We weren't able to see it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we're experiencing sort of a reality that it's kind of funny, but I don't think the left ever has. In some ways, it's an advantage because we can be less disillusioned about the world.
But, yes.
You know, it does have, in the short term, it's got consequences. But to sort of briefly return to my original point about the critical race theory stuff, I think everyone's heard about this, right? So there's sort of a quite successful campaign against critical race theory in primary schools and in secondary schools in the United States. this is basically the stuff that comes out of the colleges that's intersectional and focused on which groups are oppressors and which groups are oppressed. And, you know, Chris Rufo, the guy who did this, he put this all under the banner of critical race theory. And so he started a campaign against critical race theory, and it's really successful. The problem is I feel really strongly that Chris Rufo shot himself in the foot when he started this campaign by trying to buzzword critical race theory, because the critical race theory is the left's word. And there is this obvious name for what he's against that it would be so much more powerful. And that is anti-white, right? That's what he's against.
You see, you must know about what's her name, Carlin Borisenko or something.
Yeah.
Mean, what a joke of a woman. She's just a 2015 SJW in her mentality.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, this is the thing is, anti-white is not, it's not taking the left's buzzword and trying to repossess it like critical race theory. People can always crawl out of the woodwork and claim that you're using the wrong definition of critical race theory. It's their word and it's a buzzword. It doesn't mean anything. What makes anti-white so powerful? Anti-white so powerful because it says what it is. A, it's a plain description of truth. And B, the reason why this works now and wouldn't have worked if you tried this in the 90s is that at this stage, they all claim to be anti-white. If they say, oh, well, no one's anti-white, we'll say, okay, are you not against whiteness? And is it okay to be white? And if they say no to that, you're like, okay, that's why you're anti-white, because you just said you were.
Yes.
Right? Like, yeah. It's just... When you use language, you want your language to just kind of like drop with the gravity of truth as plainly as possible onto the floor. Just like, boom, there it is. Just like drop, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's kind of like when Trump said to the reporter, I think it was CNN, "You are fake news."
Yeah.
And it was like, poof. No one could deny that.
No, we're not. Okay, you fake this? Oh, yeah, we did. Oh, we're fake news. We can't call news fake. Well, you call news fake, right? Like, it's so obvious, right? The language is just there. So the right has to be – it can't use buzzwords. It has to just kind of, like, describe obvious realities and just sort of build that into its speech. It's anti-white because they say they're anti-white and because they're doing – anti-white things that actually harm people that they call white. I don't even really think white is a category I think is particularly relevant, but I understand that they're anti-white because they say they're against whiteness.
Yes.
They say this now. This is the new thing. They've adopted the nulla ignatia of line. So I don't know. Like, this is something the right can do. All the left's language is a pile of political contradictions. The right just describes things plainly. It has an advantage there. I think that's one huge strength. And, excuse me. Sorry, it's going through. I already went over the truth thing. The next thing I kind of wanted to get to that's a strength is, and this is actually something, I'm not trying to actually like attack you, Woz, but this is one thing that I heard you talk about and I really wanted to disagree with. The right can express aesthetics and it can express a humanist in aesthetics. And the left can't. And I think you said, I know, Gram of Woes a while back, that it's not the time for aesthetics. And I really disagree with this.
Oh, this was right. Okay. Now let me. Okay. This was probably, I do remember saying this. I do remember the episode. And I think it was a night when I was feeling quite despondent and pissed off. And somebody mentioned Fashwave. And I thought, look, my initial reaction was, look, Fashwave has been around since 2015. And it was cool then. It was kind of interesting. But I've seen enough images of a statue, like a photo of a statue overlaid on top of some digital landscape with a palm tree and all that. And it's like, so what? You know, I still feel like this way now. I mean, I don't really know what it points to. I don't know what the substance is. I know that it looks cool and I get that, well, it's combining Greek statuary with the modern world. And then it's also harking back to the 80s when there was more optimism about the future. I get that. But so what? If there were a subculture attached to it with literature and poetry and music and ideas, I could understand. But on its own, it basically is just the sort of insignia, the visual paraphernalia of the alt-right and the dissident right. And I think that on its own, it just doesn't really communicate much, except that we don't like the modern world. We have a hankering after the classical world, which very few of us actually know very much about. Mm. And we like technology. You know, I don't really think there's anything more deep to it than that. And I think that for serious culture, there has to be something more deep than that.
True. But just to get where I think I agree that those are the weaknesses of the fash wave genre. But that just means that we need to fix them. Because I always think that institutions are preceded by organized high agency, usually men, sometimes women. Pardon me. Basically organized men who are high agency and dedicated are what create institutions. And what organizes men of high agency and high will is some spiritual or aesthetic vision. And as such, you know, a truly human aesthetic is just invaluable at this stage, because that's the stage where we're at. People are looking for an animating spirit. And I think aesthetics can have an impact here. And what I kind of want to emphasize here is, you know, insofar as we already talked about sincerity of language and sincerity of belief, there's a thing that the left has left by the wayside, and that's sincerity of form. And I don't know, have you ever heard of this concept of WYSIWYG? It's this thing
from what you see is what you see is what you get.
What you see is what you get. I sincerely believe that WYSIWYG will be the banner of the aesthetic form the right takes, both in its personal presentation and in its art. And in the same way that you want your language to kind of clang on the floor of truth, you want your aesthetic to kind of clang on the floor of like, this is what we are. This is why it's hard, especially with the way the left has gone currently. It's so obvious that this whole trans thing is fake to the core, both physically and spiritually.
Go on.
And can it stand beside, you know, my favorite meme of sort of the right was, I don't know if you've seen this meme. It's this meme of, I think this person actually has a role in the Biden administration now, but it's this meme of this late onset trans woman, like this big hulking guy in a dress with, and he's like physically explaining things with like a very masculine manner to this other, you know, social justice warrior girl. And she's like hands folded, you know, looking down, very demure. And yeah, it's this utter contrast between real femininity and then simulated femininity.
Yes.
And that picture, that image is just absolute art. And what we need, the WYSIWYG aesthetic, is the crack in the simulacrum.
Okay, I get this. I think I understand the basic concept that it should be something that just breaks through taboos and also breaks through the bullshit.
Because
so much of modernity is just bullshit. We're meant to believe that this is a woman. It's obviously a guy. We all know it. He knows it. It's nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that it also, I mean, I think to be true art, though, it, more than a political point, it has to actually come to a human point.
Some people are saying that I was too harsh about fash wave. And look, I like some fash wave as well. And I like cyberpunk. I like all sorts of aesthetics. I'm famous for going on about Robocop. one of the things I love about that is when you see it from his point of view and it's the targeting thing, it's just one of the coolest things in the world. And, you know, I've raved about various things that mean a great deal to me. You know, I'm not against aesthetics, and I'm not even against Fashwave in and of itself. What I guess my exasperation comes from the idea that that is enough. It's just absolutely not enough. It's just not. I mean, I'm sorry. And I'm not trying to rain on anyone's parade. I don't want people to, like, I'm not saying you must disavow Fashwave. Do what you like with Fashwave, and I hope you continue to enjoy it. Fine. I'll continue to enjoy some of it myself, and I'll continue to enjoy other things that might be meaningless to other people. But that is not enough.
I do agree it's not enough, but maybe we could actually take a middle ground here and see how we might be able to bridge the gap, right? So my next point here is, like, another strength that the right has is that it could actually be used to forge fellowship. And I also have forgiveness for its former enemies here as well. But, you know, there's this one thing that Antedem said, where he said, well, you know, you don't need modern cinema, you don't need Netflix. You could have a hard drive full of classic movies and you'd never be able to watch all of them in your entire life. Okay, sure. And, you know, I want to be clear about this. The left will see this and the left will mock you for, they'll say, oh, well, you're stuck in the past. You're watching movies from before you're born. You're watching movies from the 80s. All the right is just nostalgia. Well, okay, sure. And there's certainly a key truth to this that you're pointing out. The reason why Fashwave doesn't work is it's obviously pure nostalgia, right? But you can sort of solidify this into something that's real. In some sense, the critique that something's from the past is bullshit when you think about it, because everything is in the past. Live stream that we're giving right now, it's a millisecond in the past, even when our listeners are listening to it live.
Yeah, of course. I'm not saying that things from the past are meaningless. I mean that I think Fashwave is shallow.
It is, because it's idealized. Yeah. It's not living. Right. Like, in order to be, so for instance, in order to be a living piece of culture, it has to embody some kind of lived reality that's going on right now. So for instance, you know, a person watching a DVD, or not DVD, no one uses DVDs, a terabyte drive full of old movies is in some sense participating in dead culture. But if someone were to create a film club where a bunch of people got together and watched, you know, in a public environment and made a ceremony out of it, then all of a sudden that piece of dead culture is creating real culture just from the act of it being human and social.
Yes, that's true.
And so I'm not so sure that we couldn't, you know, if Fashwave were to take the next step, and now is to see, like, what does it mean to sort of live this stuff? Or what does it mean to actually have a human moment inside this aesthetic? Then I think you might be able to transform something that's purely nostalgistic and shallow.
Well, you know, that's stronger. Yes, I think that's true. You know, something that I've noticed is with certain content creators is they have talent. They have creative talent, aesthetic talent. Their stuff has a certain sound, a certain look, but it doesn't feel authentic or sincere. Yeah. It feels like they're doing, hey, this is that aesthetic thing. That this is, you know, it's not human. And I think the key here is they are not, and this is going to sound very gay, but they're not exploring their own vulnerability. They're not allowing themselves to be vulnerable enough to be, to show that human side of themselves. And it's like they're doing this, they're putting on the act of creating this aesthetic, but there's no human depth to it. There's no sort of human experience encoded into the artwork. It's more like political propaganda or someone just pretending to believe in this thing.
I really like that vulnerability thing, actually.
Yeah, but it's something that I've seen with people. Like, you get people who are creatively talented, but they cannot make themselves vulnerable enough to make sincere art, right? It's a thing that I think plagues quite a lot of people, because who wants to be vulnerable? It's not, yeah. Some people are not used to being vulnerable. I think in my case, I'm too used to being vulnerable, actually.
Well, I mean, I think you produce pretty good. Your aesthetic is actually pretty outstanding, you know. I think it's... Well,
thank you very much. But either way, yeah, I think it has benefited me creatively. It's detrimented me in other ways. But yeah, I think it has... I'm very at home with, you know, opening Photoshop or whatever and designing something, creating something that is meaningful to me. It's not just the right colors, the right shapes, the right textures, and they all fit together into an aesthetic that people will recognize. It has to feel right to me. And as I say, I think that there are creative people who are talented, but they don't know how to insert themselves into their work. And the result is shallowness. Now, I could easily imagine that Fashwave... I could easily imagine a better Fashwave, right? Where there is depth to it and there is sincerity to it. But if you're just going to constantly skirt on the and flirt like an ice skater on the surface of this thing, then it's going to remain as shallow as it has remained for the last 5 years. And it will be something that's cool to look at, but nobody will really feel much when they look at it, when they try to embrace it and feel nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's... I don't know. This is the problem, is that this is sort of the extent that I can go, is just observe this from the outside, because I'm not really an artist and I don't have an understanding. I am an appreciator of art. My thought in this is, you know, I think that there has to be sort of a lived reality to art in a community that surrounds it. And I think this is why art has kind of been stifled, is that very few of it, there's very little of it that has sort of a lived community around it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this is something that people have tried to organize on the right over the last, well, during the time that I've been involved. But it's difficult. I think that part of it is that, well, organizing anything online is bloody difficult. There are various problems here. And this is one thing where I find myself wishing for funding, like, because I know that if you could incentivize people that way, they would get on board and they'd feel that invested in it and they'd care about it. But if you can't offer them that, then it's like, well, why should I get involved? Why should I care? And why should I make myself vulnerable in multiple ways?
But aren't we doing the thing here where we're trying to be the left, right? Because, you know, I think that I'm getting to my last point here. So I know we're going really over time, but you know, the funding thing. I mean, we're not going to have funding the way the left does. Like, I mean, we're going to have some. And I think we'll probably have more than we do right now. But we're not going to, I mean, the left, just the amount of money that goes into the left is just disgusting. It floods money onto its projects like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, I think it's obscene. I mean, it's amounts of money that we can't even conceive of, really, because it's just so alien. It's a completely different situation where you'd have the PR departments, human resource departments, legal department, all this kind of stuff.
The content creators who do leftist politics, like, there are a number of them from back in the day, like ContraPoints and Sean. I mean, these channels produce like a video a year, if that. And they get like financed to the tune of a six-figure salary.
It's astounding.
Absolutely. I can't imagine it. That's what it means to be. I just don't think we're going to have that kind of money. And I think that, you know, we're going to have to fall back on sort of the last point, I think, is that the right can embrace a sort of natural order to things. And I have sort of three examples of this here. I don't think that the left can do any of these things. The first one is that we can kind of embrace an appropriate hierarchy. We really have to prioritize, and you said this before on many occasions, so I'm preaching to the choir here for you, Woz, but we have to approach our communities to increase quality, not quantity. And inside those communities, we have to appreciate a certain amount of deference and appropriate hierarchy. Like, you know, academic agent is so much more knowledgeable on me and a number of things. And I don't have to get into a contest with him about that. I can defer to him on those things. And I think there's this online temptation to always be backbiting, to always try to come in with a minor correction and create drama.
Yeah.
We absolutely have to blow that up.
I completely agree. And I've been saying this for quite a long time. I think that ideally we would have a mechanism by which to jettison people from the community who are just troublemakers.
The second part of this is, and this is my appeal to you and me, was the right needs to demonstrate a gracefulness in age. I'm not so sure. I mean, I think that this is the left can be cool easier than the right can because they're pushing the cart down the hill. They're relaxing. They can be the eternal teenager, and teenagers want to believe that they can be eternally teenagers. The right has to go in the opposite direction. The right can never try to make traditionalism cool in the way that the left makes its own aesthetics cool. This is why anime increases degeneracy rather than decreases it, is because it fundamentally sells an aesthetic that comes from a worldview that it doesn't embody through its teenage protagonists, and therefore is fake. And so kids who get into it, they learn the value of being fake more than they learn the value of being timeless or old.
Yes.
And so this is something that's not been explored very much inside the internet community because everything is about newness. But if the right can master the gracefulness of aging, it will create a dynamic that will be in the long term incredibly problematic for the left. I just watched a TJ, the Amazing Atheist video. I don't know how this came up. I think someone I followed did a response video to him. That guy's not looking good. He's looking pretty bad. And his sharpness has not increased in time, too. And, like, you know, I know that's his aesthetic is to be a mess. But that guy's pushing 40, at least. If he's not over 40.
There does come a time when you... And, you know, I should be careful what I say here. But, I'm glad that I'm not living at home anymore. You know, I think it was understandable at 31 if you've had a terrible 20s. It's understandable, especially nowadays.
But no, I'm not saying you have to have a good job and kids and all that.
But the stuff that goes alongside that, like not dressing well, not, you know, eventually you do have to grow up.
When I was a young child, you know how you always hear your parents talk about other adults? And one of the most cutting insults, and I didn't know exactly what this even meant, but I understood that it was really bad and I could see it. And I didn't know what it meant until very recently, is when my mother said, oh, that man, he never really felt comfortable in his own skin, in his own body. And she was referring to somebody who's, I mean, he's kind of a LARPer. He was this guy that, you know, he was sort of this jet setter in his 50s. And, you know, he didn't have any relationships or roots. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that this is a comment on the fact that he didn't have a family or a career. It was a comment on just how he held himself.
Yeah.
And somehow it was really cutting. And I'm not the first to wonder if this is not going to be a serious downfall for our opponents, potentially a serious opportunity for ourselves. Yeah. Our bodies are aging. You know, we're not teenagers forever, and pretending to be that is ridiculous. And I think the right can age better than the left can.
Well, like an interesting example to reference something from earlier would be Sarah Silverman. You know, she can get away with being this bitch when she's young and skinny, but she's, I don't know how old she is now. I think she's about, in fact, I'll find out. But as you get older, you just start to look like Barbara Spector.
Yeah, and I should say this. Joan Rivers demonstrated that you could be a bitch and be aging and still be funny. But Joan Rivers was way more talented than Sarah Silverman.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that Sarah Silverman's shtick was her innocence.
Right.
And it was this, it was basically like little girl says outrageous thing at dinner. And isn't that precious? And that doesn't, Joan Rivers was always sort of the drunken why not?
See,
why not, you know?
Yeah. And this struggle on the part of Sarah Silverman is perhaps epitomized by her doing this Santa Inc. thing, where she's a 51-year-old woman playing effectively a wee girl.
Yeah, and she always does, right?
Yeah, and it's ridiculous.
I mean, there's just no Joan Rivers role for her to play because Joan Rivers has too much agency. Right? When Joan Rivers is cruel or racist, you just have to accept that you can be cruel or racist in full possession of your wits. And when Sarah Silverman is cruel or racist, her excuse is, I'm a kid. That was always her excuse, right?
Right.
And at some point, you can't believe you're a kid anymore, right? It either has to be, oh, right, to be crude and racist and cruel. And cruelness was really always Sarah Silverman's shtick.
Yeah.
But once agency is attached to that cruelty, it becomes a lot less cute.
Yeah, exactly. And then you've got the male side where you've got these guys who who are the Peter Pan thing. Like, he's in his 40s. He's still dressing like he's in his late teens. It kind of looks ridiculous.
I mean, you know, society can have a few Peter Pans in their 60s, but man, a horde of them is scary. And people naturally repulse by that.
Yeah.
I think people will look for something different.
Yeah.
And so the last thing I want to mention, and this is the most important one, is the natural order of things is the rhythm of the season. And it kind of brings us full circle because the most optimistic thing I think that came out of this year, Academic Agent did this. Semei Goggs talked about this, and I'm not trying to steal the win from his Semei Goggs sales because I don't think he's come on yet. And this is an embodiment of what we're doing right now is, everything that is ordered in our life occurs in patterns and in time. And what happened, what Academic Agent experimented with is to create certain days where everyone does the same thing and to create sort of a rhythm. He got into this argument with Adam and Sitch over Julius Evola instead of being a dumbass like I was and trying to debate them. And you can go look at my debate with Adam and Sitch. It was the last thing I did this year because I've been pretty busy with other things. It's silly, but Academic Agent had a much better response, and that was to create a day where the chief thing that they were mocking, which was in this case Julius Evola, they would have a celebration of it. And I'm not a Julius Evola fan at all. And they continued the pattern with Carlisle. And this created this incredible learning opportunity, even for people who didn't like Julius Evola. And this incredible feeling of community where people who weren't content creators and people who were, they would all participate in this thing. That's the kind of thing that you'd experience in real life. And it was created in microcosm on the internet.
Yeah.
And you have this wholesomeness, and this is why millennial is so powerful. This year's millennial, by all accounts, should be less powerful than last year's because last year's was on YouTube, right?
Yeah.
But somehow it feels more powerful. It feels more powerful because everyone's participating in this community. We're all coming together.
Yes.
It's because it's part of this pattern of our lives. Millennial will live for as long as it might even outlive you, right? I mean, I'm serious, right? Because it's become a pattern of human existence now. It follows that. And once you give some event and some mode of existence a human quality, it clicks into our spirits.
I think so. And then people feel about that event differently than they would if it were just an arbitrary thing that one person is trying to arrange right now, this year only. If it's part of a rhythm, if it's something that happens every year, then people don't want to let themselves down. They don't want to miss out, and they don't want to let other people down. Not taking part in it. So obviously millennial would be a very good example of that. But I hope that there are others. I mean, Frodi does his, oh God, I've forgotten the name of it. Decameron Film Festival every spring. I'm sure he'll do that again this coming spring. I think that's a good example of it as well. I think there should be multiple examples of this where we have a sort of calendar of things that happen that people can expect each year.
Well, this is where I don't want to steal the whale out of some AGOG sales. I was thinking about the seasonality being a strength. And then before I could write anything about that, Semi Agog came up with the idea. He said that we need a calendar, a sort of book of days, so to speak. That's what they used to call them, right? Where the things that are celebrated on each day are listed and shared so that the community can kind of function around this natural season of things.
Mm. Yes, I like that. I mean, the only danger I can see with it is that it could become cultish, and someone from outside who's not part of this community could see that and think, "Oh my God, I've got to sign up to all these things. I've got to dress a certain way and listen to a certain type of music and have certain posters on my wall."
Well,
it could seem a bit prescriptive and limiting, but
everything can decay. Right. And so, you know, the thing is that ceremonies need to have a strong hand at the wheel while they develop their own internal character. But Christmas is a perfect example. I mean, you can't corrupt Christmas.
Well, right. They tried, but they failed.
You can, but the memory is too strong because the aesthetic memory that's written into our art is too strong. It's too forceful. It doesn't want to move in that direction.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's why, and I don't know why we obviously can't create a new Christmas, but if we find these human modes and we play into them, I think this is something that the right can do and the left can't, that creates a huge opportunity.
Yeah. Well, it's an opportunity for sincerity, for something meaningful. And I think the left are averse or even allergic to that.
No, they fear it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that seems like a good point to end it.
All right. I've taken you way over time, so.
Well, I've just realized that it is nearly 4:30. So, but however, we do have some questions.
Okay, so, I'll answer them quickly.
Yeah. So we'll go through those. Okay. Now. A common theme on the right is to categorize the COVID regime as a kind of religion. Is this a valid analogy? Now, everyone knows my views on this, so I won't comment. What do you think?
It's a religious phenomenon, but not a new religion. It's the same old religion of John Lennon's Imagine that we know and love or hate.
Yeah, it's fulfilling the need and the human impulse for religion, but it's not a religion as such, of course.
And it's an eschatological event, and eschatological events like the ghost dance cover up from visible weakness, which would be apparent otherwise.
Right, okay. What does the distributor see as the extent of cooperation within the distant right between the Christian NRX types and people simply concerned with ethnocentrism or nationalism? How would he pitch NRX to nationalists? What do we gain from each other?
NRX is simply a theory of power and a model of how oligarchies and institutions operate. It does not exclude the possibility of a nefarious super elite that's operating it, but it is, in my opinion, a very accurate model for how institutions naturally corrupt and become amenable to bad actors over time. NRX is totally morally neutral. You can use it as a Christian, as a nationalist. It's just a description of how things work, in my opinion. And in my opinion, it's the accurate one. I think perhaps a more pertinent question is, how can Christians and nationalists and pagans get together? And I think it's just by being as sincere as possible. You know, if you're a nationalist, I respect people who want to preserve their ethnicity, and I want to preserve my own ethnicity, right? You know, I tend to think it's a secondary, but let's just have a sincere conversation about that, right?
Yes, indeed. There was some opprobrium in the live chat earlier on when you said that white wasn't a category that you thought was very relevant. I think that you mean that you would actually go narrower than... Well, what
do you mean? Well, I mean, it, I mean, white can mean a few things. It can be a stand-in for Christendom, the Western civilization, the lands of the Roman Empire that were Christian, which is a very real civilization and a very real civilizational tradition. You know, evidence for it going back. It stands in for a family of different European ethnicities that were all within Christendom. And it was a racial category in the United States. I don't know. I think I would think that if you were to create a new ethnicity, you'd want to organize it around a religion. Ethnogenesis typically comes from religion, not religions from ethnicity, in my opinion. And if you're going for an older one, I think you'd want to go deeper rather than shallow. I don't really know what kind of cultural elements can you associate with just whiteness without any further qualities? Almost nothing. To be more historically accurate, you'd say Christendom or historic Christendom or the dreaded Western civilization if you're a neocon, but it means the same thing, right? So I don't know, go broader or go narrower, because this whiteness thing just plays into the crude stereotype of sort of the racial category that existed fleetingly between 1865 and 1965 for 100 years in America. And I'm not so sure what that means.
Okay. Dave, did you see the message to American Catholics from Cardinal Carlo Maria Vigano? Any thoughts on leadership coming from rogue elites in the Vatican to lead the church back from the abyss?
I think Vigano is the classic example of a rogue elite. He's exactly what I want to see. I've been incredibly disappointed with the church leadership. I've seen movement. I mean, maybe I shouldn't be talking about this, but I've been seeing the bishops have been basically, a lot of the bishops have been empowered to take other trad leaders inside parishes that I'm a part of and basically boot them off to Craigie Island or the American equivalents. That's how you get rid of politically inconvenient people. It's not because money's resting in accounts, because you don't like their politics.
Reference to Father Ted there.
Yeah. Okay. I've been really, but it heartens me to see that as they're doing this, a number of other leaders see that they're doing this and are not going to do this. And eventually these people are going to falter and they're going to misstep, and we're not going anywhere. We have to get through this, because I do not think that the corruption in the church ultimately discredits its holy mission. It's temporary. There will be a counter-reformation. There will be a correction to this corruption.
Okay. All right. The Distributist, what made you decide on your choice of name? Are you a fan of G.K. Chesterton?
I'm very much a fan of G.K. Chesterton, and I hate that, because every Catholic who's my age has G.K. Chesterton. It's such a cliche. I know it's like having a Viking-themed Nordic nationalist channel. I mean, like, come on, think of something else, right? Like, just for once, can't the Nordic nationalists be a fan of, like, you know, the 17th century Swedish army that fought in the 30 Years' War? Like, those guys were badasses. Well, don't steal their aesthetics, right? You know, I like those guys way more. But it's always like the Vikings, right? That's always what it is. Oh, fine. And I really dislike what I chose. I just wanted something that began with a D. To be honest. And I picked this one because I liked G.K. Chesterton, and I wasn't aware at that time what a horrible cliche I was playing into with Catholic bloggers. And I would have never chosen G.K. Chesterton as an icon. But he is truly a wonderful author, and everyone should read him. Specifically, Orthodoxy. I cannot recommend that book enough.
Yeah. And I guess the takeaway here is that you chose that avatar before it was cool.
No, I chose it before I knew that it wasn't cool.
Okay.
I wish I could say that I liked G.K. Chesterton before it was cool. Absolutely not.
All right. Critical race theory is just what the American theology has been for 60 years or more. The right struggles with using language offensively, while the left have become experts.
I just think that this is the tool of power. You can use language offensively. I mean, try using language offensively against the left. And do you remember reverse discrimination?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
reverse racism.
Reverse racism, reverse discrimination. Like this was a right wing buzzword from the Rush Limbaugh era, right? And the left ingeniously turned this around so that very real discrimination in the form of affirmative action became, what they did was they said, there's no discrimination. There's no reverse racism. There's just racism. Like if I was racist against a white person, I wouldn't be reverse racist against a white person. I'd just be racist against a white person. You know, leaving aside the fact that what they were complaining against was actual racism under that definition.
Yes.
And then for a generation, you know, every time a right winger complained about anti-white racism, a leftist would crawl out from the woodworks to think, are you complaining about reverse racism? Don't you know that reverse racism doesn't exist? And, you know, the brain dead centrists would think that this was some right wing attempt to elevate anti-white racism as some category of moral failing, worse than racism against another group, which of course it never was. It was just pointing out that this was going on.
Well, this is a tactic that I've seen used where they pretend to address the thing by addressing something that was never brought up, or that doesn't matter. So, for example, with critical race theory, they say, oh, well, that's just in the legal sphere. Why are you saying that that's something in education or in society in general when it came from the legal sphere? And that's a fatuous thing to say because, yeah, okay, it emerged there in the first place, but it is now everywhere.
Or do you think that we shouldn't learn about slavery? That's the other one, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are many. There are so many.
But like, if you have the microphone, you can make those moves. Like, power gives you the ability to do that. Try to do that. I mean, by all means, go ahead and try to do this to the left. It doesn't work. You can't create long-lasting buzzwords against the left. They inevitably turn them around.
Yeah, and there are other examples that we don't need to go into them. Mm. Okay, Soccer City says, Woz is right about Fashwave, but forgets that all music nowadays is in the shitter. I wasn't saying that it's bad. I was just saying that it's not enough, and it frustrates me that people invest so much faith in it and hope in it. I think we have to do better, and I think that we can do better. So that's why I'm exasperated with it. It's not because the thing in and of itself is crap. I don't think it is. I just don't think it's enough. And the deficiencies of it become apparent or are especially apparent to me because I know other people are thinking this is enough.
Right? Maybe you've, of course, heard the... you know, you've heard the sort of neo-folk European scene like Death in June.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of their music, but I think they were thinking in the right direction. And they may have been a bit before their time, right? And so I wouldn't imagine if something like that could hopefully with... I don't like the music particularly. I would hope that you could go in a direction like that. Not so much with the musical style, but with your approach to music, where you're actually kind of like, there's a sort of an auteurist force behind it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But again, that gets to the heart of what I was saying earlier. It feels sincere. It doesn't feel like they're just, like they've just found a certain style or aesthetic and they're, or we can put those clothes on. That'll make us, that's enough. No, that it's, there has to be sincerity. As I was saying earlier, I don't need to go into that again. Gus Faye says, most of the 2015-16 memes are stale and ring hollow now. We have to keep doing new things. We can't fall into esoteric nostalgia for 6 years ago. Our enemies are actually evolving.
I mean, I agree with the first part. The last part, maybe not so much.
Yeah, I think what he means is that they're adapting, and they are, because there was a time when the alt-right felt, and you know that whole thing, it felt new, and kind of challenging and a bit scary. And I think the left were genuinely scared by it. But they're not now. It's like the Borg, you know, they've updated, they've adapted. So you've got to keep doing that.
And I think that the elites, like the Great Reset people, I think they've done a lot more adapting than the ideological left. I think the ideological left is brain dead.
Yeah, well, that gets back to, does Vosch actually believe anything he says at this point, or is it all just nonsense and hollow words? But I do agree with you that the elite, the Great Reset types, I mean, either they've been planning this for decades, or they've really evolved quickly over the last few years, and maybe both. Yeah, maybe it was a combination of those two.
I just think that there's a lot of money, and there's something that, like, this is their only option, is to evolve in this way, because all the other options they wanted to go are closed off.
Right. Okay. Luke says, I'm boxing Sam Hyde in mid-January because I called him a pussy on Twitter. So he agreed to fight me. So I'm flying up to Rhode Island. Do you think a 270-pound, 5'11" man knocking Sam Hyde out will be a positive development for the far right? What do you think about the idea of a far-right internet boxing league? Fucking hell.
Well, actually, I proposed something. I have proposed. Well, so, actually, someone proposed this to me, and I thought it was a great idea, of everyone who stars in Millennial having a giant single elimination chess tournament. I suck at chess, but I would just, that would be so much fun. I would be eliminated round one for sure. But I kind of am curious about who plays the best chess game. I think, like, Academic Agent probably will pull ahead. I think I don't know if he plays chess, but I get the sense that he has the chess player's demeanor.
Or the Franklin, surely. I mean, I can imagine it would be, it would end up with a right down to the wire battle between the Franklin and Academic Agent.
Come on, make this happen. Or actually, really any game, to be quite honest. I'm a huge strategy board game fan. Go, chess, or Euro games, even really nerdy strategy games. Like, I'm all over it. So I would love to have that be an element of fellowship here.
Well, somebody else can arrange that.
Yeah.
That can be somebody else's thing. Okay. Why? I'm disturbed by how few people, this is from Soccer City again, I'm disturbed by how few people here realize that symphonic heavy metal is the natural true music of the dissident right. What could be more European? Let's make that remembered in 2022. Symphonic heavy metal.
I don't know. I guess I'm not. Are you a fan of that genre?
I've never even heard of it until now.
Well, I think he means like Dream Theater, right?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, this is just not my world. I personally would like something like folk. I love folk music. I'm sort of either the Gaelic folk or the Americana folk is just, that was totally my scene. And it's so attuned to the right ways of thinking. Yeah, I wouldn't imagine if you could resurrect that too. But we'll have to see what develops, right?
Yes. Okay. I desperately need some sleep.
Okay. So, all right. Good.
All right. So I think we've answered all the questions, so that should be fine. I think this has been a very interesting discussion. Sorry, I sort of flaked out a bit towards the end. But
no problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I've enjoyed this. I think it was definitely worthwhile. Okay. Well, thank you, Distributist, for appearing on Millennial 2021.
My pleasure, as always. Have a great Christmas and a happy new year.
Sorry, that's my alarm clock's going off.
Well, I'll make the well wishes again. Everyone have a very blessed Christmas, and hopefully spend it with friends, family, and failing that with God and with the spirituality you have personally at the stage in your development.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll be back tomorrow night with four streams. The first is Godfrey Bloom, who was on last year. Apostolic Majesty, who will be his first time on Millennial. Then The Franklin, and then Gregory Hood, and that will be his first time on Millennial. So that should be good. Godfrey Bloom was very popular last year. And yeah, the other three, I always enjoy speaking to the Franklin. He's an old friend of mine. So yeah, and the other two, it's unknown quantities, but I'm sure it'll be interesting. Okay, well, thank you, Distributist. Thank you, everyone. Take a look at the NFT, take a look at the T-shirt, and the other ways that you can support me and help Millennial to happen. In the meantime, good night and bye for now.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.